Egzamin maturalny z języka angielskiego. Poziom dwujęzyczny. Usłyszysz dwukrotnie teksty do zadań od pierwszego do trzeciego. Przed wysłuchaniem każdego tekstu usłyszysz dźwięk. W nagraniu przewidziane są przerwy na zapoznanie się z poleceniami oraz treścią zadań, sygnalizowane dźwiękiem. Rozwiązuj poszczególne zadania w trakcie słuchania nagrań oraz w czasie przerw po ich wysłuchaniu.
Task 1. Read the instructions and the task carefully.
Speaker A.
Last summer, I came across a bag of stale tortilla chips. To revive them, I decided to toss them into the toaster oven. I guess I must have set the temperature wrong, because they burnt to a crisp very quickly. When after 10 minutes I saw one of them going up in flames, I thought that the fire plus electrics combo was really bad news. I freaked out and immediately opened the toaster oven to prevent a catastrophe. Yet it didn't occur to me that I'd be letting in way more oxygen, and the flames exploded out of the oven. Fortunately, I kept my head and tossed the whole tray into the sink. The oven glove I was wearing was only slightly singed, but the food was ruined.
Speaker B. It was our wedding anniversary, so I decided to surprise my wife and came up with the idea of making steaks in cognac. Even though I'd repeatedly proved to be all thumbs in the kitchen, I knuckled down to the new challenge. I started frying the fillets and got the cognac ready. However, when I was pouring the liquor into the pan, I got really heavy-handed and the alcohol caught fire, creating a very impressive volcano effect. The roaring fireball was so big that it was sucked up into the vent fan over the stove, set the filter on fire, and melted the plastic fan blades. My wife got alarmed by the peculiar smell drifting up from the kitchen and rushed in from the garden. I guess she was afraid that I'd aggravate the situation, so she grabbed the fire extinguisher and sprayed everything, including the would-be steaks. Speaker C.
Last month, I bought a spit roast attachment for my charcoal grill. Anxious to try out my new gadget, I placed a few pieces of pork on the skewer and positioned it over the drip pan. Content that everything was well, I retreated to the house. 30 minutes later, I heard what sounded like rain, so I went outside to check that it wasn't raining too hard, only to find my entire backyard engulfed in flames. It turned out that the sound I thought was rain was actually the popping sound of coals falling on the ground and igniting a backyard full of pine needles. A garden hose which had caught fire was making things worse, as it had spread the flames to wooden chairs on the lawn. To put the fire out, I desperately chopped off the part of the hose that was on fire so that I could use what was left to soak everything else. Obviously, the dinner was wasted, but I managed to prevent further disaster. Listen to the recording once again.
Speaker A.
Last summer, I came across a bag of stale tortilla chips. To revive them, I decided to toss them into the toaster oven. I guess I must have set the temperature wrong, because they burnt to a crisp very quickly. When after 10 minutes I saw one of them going up in flames, I thought that the fire plus electrics combo was really bad news. I freaked out and immediately opened the toaster oven to prevent a catastrophe. Yet it didn't occur to me that I'd be letting in way more oxygen, and the flames exploded out of the oven. Fortunately, I kept my head and tossed the whole tray into the sink. The oven glove I was wearing was only slightly singed, but the food was ruined.
Speaker B. It was our wedding anniversary, so I decided to surprise my wife and came up with the idea of making steaks in cognac. Even though I'd repeatedly proved to be all thumbs in the kitchen, I knuckled down to the new challenge. I started frying the fillets and got the cognac ready. However, when I was pouring the liquor into the pan, I got really heavy-handed and the alcohol caught fire, creating a very impressive volcano effect. The roaring fireball was so big that it was sucked up into the vent fan over the stove, set the filter on fire, and melted the plastic fan blades. My wife got alarmed by the peculiar smell drifting up from the kitchen and rushed in from the garden. I guess she was afraid that I'd aggravate the situation, so she grabbed the fire extinguisher and sprayed everything, including the would-be steaks. Speaker C.
Last month, I bought a spit roast attachment for my charcoal grill. Anxious to try out my new gadget, I placed a few pieces of pork on the skewer and positioned it over the drip pan. Content that everything was well, I retreated to the house. 30 minutes later, I heard what sounded like rain, so I went outside to check that it wasn't raining too hard, only to find my entire backyard engulfed in flames. It turned out that the sound I thought was rain was actually the popping sound of coals falling on the ground and igniting a backyard full of pine needles. A garden hose which had caught fire was making things worse, as it had spread the flames to wooden chairs on the lawn. To put the fire out, I desperately chopped off the part of the hose that was on fire so that I could use what was left to soak everything else. Obviously, the dinner was wasted, but I managed to prevent further disaster. Task 2. Read the instructions and the questions for text 1 carefully. Listen to the recording for text 1. On his 30th birthday, Dan McLaughlin decided to become a professional golfer. He wanted to test a theory he'd read about in the Malcolm Gladwell bestseller Outliers, based on research suggesting that practice is the essence of genius. Gladwell popularized the idea that, regardless of a person's natural aptitude, 10,000 hours of deliberate and appropriately guided practice was the magic number of greatness. He claimed that with this amount of practice, anyone could achieve a level of proficiency that would rival that of a professional. The idea appealed to Dan, who set himself the goal of developing his skills well enough to make his appearance in the Professional Golfers Association Tour. First, Dan spoke to Dr. Erickson, the original researcher behind the 10,000 hours rule. Dan intended to practice for 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, and get to the 10,000 mark in 3.5 years. But after discussing concentration levels and learning absorption with Dr. Erickson, they agreed it had to be a much longer project. A typical day would be between 4 and 6 hours of practice literally standing over a ball, followed by a handful of extracurricular activities such as working out, watching training videos, and meditation. The days would be long, but only the time spent literally working with the ball would count towards the 10,000 hours. With over 60 million golfers in the world, qualifying for the PGA Tour might seem like climbing Mount Everest in flip-flops. Many professionals share this view and argue that the do-it-yourself routine will never let you reach the level required to compete with Tiger Woods, certainly not at Dan's age. Undeterred by such opinions, Dan is pursuing his path single-mindedly. He sticks to deliberate practice, which means isolating specific aspects of a larger task and focusing on them until they are improved. This way, he aims to prove what some instructors suggest, namely that such practice could be more effective than repeating the whole task over and over, in order to improve overall performance. Dan has already clocked up over 6,000 hours, and he is meticulously tracking his progress on his website, which has attracted a steadily swelling crowd of intrigued followers. Dan is enjoying the challenge he took on. "What guy wouldn't want to go out and practice golf for 9 years?" he says jokingly. Listen to the recording once again. On his 30th birthday, Dan McLaughlin decided to become a professional golfer. He wanted to test a theory he'd read about in the Malcolm Gladwell bestseller Outliers. Based on research suggesting that practice is the essence of genius, Gladwell popularized the idea that, regardless of a person's natural aptitude, 10,000 hours of deliberate and appropriately guided practice was the magic number of greatness. He claimed that with this amount of practice, anyone could achieve a level of proficiency that would rival that of a professional. The idea appealed to Dan, who set himself the goal of developing his skills well enough to make his appearance in the Professional Golfers Association Tour. First, Dan spoke to Dr. Erickson, the original researcher behind the 10,000 hours rule. Dan intended to practice for 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, and get to the 10,000 mark in 3.5 years. But after discussing concentration levels and learning absorption with Dr. Erickson, they agreed it had to be a much longer project. A typical day would be between 4 and 6 hours of practice literally standing over a ball, followed by a handful of extracurricular activities such as working out, watching training videos, and meditation. The days would be long, but only the time spent literally working with the ball would count towards the 10,000 hours. With over 60 million golfers in the world, qualifying for the PGA Tour might seem like climbing Mount Everest in flip-flops. Many professionals share this view and argue that the do-it-yourself routine will never let you reach the level required to compete with Tiger Woods, certainly not at Dan's age. Undeterred by such opinions, Dan is pursuing his path single-mindedly. He sticks to deliberate practice, which means isolating specific aspects of a larger task and focusing on them until they are improved. This way, he aims to prove what some instructors suggest, namely that such practice could be more effective than repeating the whole task over and over, in order to improve overall performance. Dan has already clocked up over 6,000 hours, and he is meticulously tracking his progress on his website, which has attracted a steadily swelling crowd of intrigued followers. Dan is enjoying the challenge he took on. "What guy wouldn't want to go out and practice golf for 9 years?" he says jokingly. Read the questions for text 2. Listen to the recording for text 2.
Do you think it's possible to capture the world in a drop of water? Our guest, Marcus, who specializes in water drop photographs, has proved that it is. Marcus, why did you opt for water-based high-speed photography?
When I bought my first camera a few years ago, I just wanted to take good family pictures. But then I started to read about camera settings and lighting, and one day while browsing different websites, I came across amazing high-speed pictures of water drops. These images gave rise to my own experiments in this genre, and after a couple of trial-and-error attempts, I got so immersed that I didn't feel like doing anything else.
Your most famous image is that of the planet Earth visible in a drop of water. But you also create unforgettable images of water droplets by themselves. How do you produce them?
Most of them were taken using the so-called drop-on-drop technique. It works with two drops. When the first drop falls into the water, initially it forms a crater, then a crown, and finally a pillar. The second drop must be timed in such a way that it lands on the pillar. At the moment of collision, different shapes are formed, for example, mushrooms, hats, or flying discs. When I increase the distance between the first and the second drop, the shape turns into a flying disc. When I make the distance smaller, the shape resembles something like a hat.
You must be very quick to take a shot at the right moment.
It's impossible to be that quick. Normally, I thicken my water with some transparent substance like guar gum to make the shapes hold longer before they collapse. The liquid should have the consistency of milk or cream.
And the last question. Some people say that quality water drop pictures are only possible when you use an automatic timing device. Do you agree?
I wouldn't say so. I know many people using highly specialized gear who still produce photos below standard. Gadgets won't do the trick. The genre I have chosen requires mainly one thing, a lot of patience. The shapes cannot be calculated. The only way to get the desired result is to adjust the settings and keep releasing the droplets until you get the perfect image. That usually means taking about 100 shots. But for me, that's the fun of it.
Listen to the recording once again.
Do you think it's possible to capture the world in a drop of water? Our guest, Marcus, who specializes in water drop photographs, has proved that it is. Marcus, why did you opt for water-based high-speed photography?
When I bought my first camera a few years ago, I just wanted to take good family pictures. But then I started to read about camera settings and lighting, and one day while browsing different websites, I came across amazing high-speed pictures of water drops. These images gave rise to my own experiments in this genre, and after a couple of trial-and-error attempts, I got so immersed that I didn't feel like doing anything else.
Your most famous image is that of the planet Earth visible in a drop of water. But you also create unforgettable images of water droplets by themselves. How do you produce them?
Most of them were taken using the so-called drop-on-drop technique. It works with two drops. When the first drop falls into the water, initially it forms a crater, then a crown, and finally a pillar. The second drop must be timed in such a way that it lands on the pillar. At the moment of collision, different shapes are formed, for example, mushrooms, hats, or flying discs. When I increase the distance between the first and the second drop, the shape turns into a flying disc. When I make the distance smaller, the shape resembles something like a hat.
You must be very quick to take a shot at the right moment.
It's impossible to be that quick. Normally, I thicken my water with some transparent substance like guar gum to make the shapes hold longer before they collapse. The liquid should have the consistency of milk or cream.
And the last question. Some people say that quality water drop pictures are only possible when you use an automatic timing device. Do you agree?
I wouldn't say so. I know many people using highly specialized gear who still produce photos below standard. Gadgets won't do the trick. The genre I have chosen requires mainly one thing, a lot of patience. The shapes cannot be calculated. The only way to get the desired result is to adjust the settings and keep releasing the droplets until you get the perfect image. That usually means taking about 100 shots. But for me, that's the fun of it.
Task 3. Read the instructions and the task carefully. My guest tonight is Lauren Coleman, a pioneer of cryptozoology. Lauren, was there a specific event that triggered your interest in the subject?
When I was about 13, I saw a Japanese movie, Half Human. It was about the abominable snowman, better known as the Yeti. I got fascinated with it and wanted to know more about such creatures, but the adults around me did not take my question seriously. When I asked my teachers what this business about the Yeti was, I was given three blunt answers. They don't exist. Get back to your studies. And don't bother me with that. Not much of an encouragement.
I guess our listeners are curious to know what cryptozoology is about.
Well, cryptozoology is the study of animals and other creatures that have not yet been accepted by science as real. Such animals are known as cryptids. Cryptozoologists try to prove that they might exist. Although cryptozoology doesn't enjoy as much respect as other scientific disciplines, it has had some spectacular success stories. There are numerous examples of animals which were considered mythical and then turned out to be real. For instance, mountain gorillas or okapi. Most of the time, cryptozoologists do not work in the field. The likelihood of encountering the animals we pursue is so small that it wouldn't make sense to organize expeditions. It is much easier for us to collect sightings from witnesses who came across a cryptid by accident. Since most cryptids belong in the realms of myths or fantasy, our main job is not to prove that a certain cryptid exists, but rather to collect evidence to keep the question open. If there is a chance it might exist, we can attract zoologists' attention. And this in turn brings the kind of research funding necessary to discover a new species.
What do you think attracts people to cryptids?
The Yeti, Bigfoot and Nessie are what I call celebrity cryptids. Why are people drawn to these creatures? For one thing, most of us like mysteries. And also, as humans, we take a keen interest in animals that exhibit a close likeness to us, especially mammals that are human-sized and bigger.
There's also a lot of media interest in such creatures.
That's true. The problem is that the media mainly talk about cryptids as monsters, fueling stereotypes that are hard to overcome. Myths and rumors of Bigfoot, Nessie, or the Yeti are usually covered as sensational topics, and as a result, reporters and journalists tend to imply that cryptozoologists are all hoaxers.
Cryptozoology is often described as a pseudoscience. What do you say to that?
It's true that the field is still frowned upon by the scientific community. As for the majority of scientists, cryptozoology fails to adhere to scientific methods and standards of empirical research. However, advocates of the discipline assert that cryptozoology should be recognised as a legitimate science and classified as a subfield of zoology. For me, it spans zoology, popular culture, folklore, ethnography, anthropology, and many other sciences and deserves to be taken seriously.
Thank you for being here with us today. Listen to the recording once again. My guest tonight is Lauren Coleman, a pioneer of cryptozoology. Lauren, was there a specific event that triggered your interest in the subject?
When I was about 13, I saw a Japanese movie, Half Human. It was about the abominable snowman, better known as the Yeti. I got fascinated with it and wanted to know more about such creatures, but the adults around me did not take my questions seriously. When I asked my teachers what this business about the Yeti was, I was given three blunt answers. They don't exist. Get back to your studies. And don't bother me with that. Not much of an encouragement.
I guess our listeners are curious to know what cryptozoology is about.
Well, cryptozoology is the study of animals and other creatures that have not yet been accepted by science as real. Such animals are known as cryptids. Cryptozoologists try to prove that they might exist. Although cryptozoology doesn't enjoy as much respect as other scientific disciplines, it has had some spectacular success stories. There are numerous examples of animals which were considered mythical and then turned out to be real. For instance, mountain gorillas or okapi. Most of the time, cryptozoologists do not work in the field. The likelihood of encountering the animals we pursue is so small that it wouldn't make sense to organise expeditions. It is much easier for us to collect sightings from witnesses who came across a cryptid by accident. Since most cryptids belong in the realms of myths or fantasy, our main job is not to prove that a certain cryptid exists, but rather to collect evidence to keep the question open. If there is a chance it might exist, we can attract zoologists' attention. And this in turn brings the kind of research funding necessary to discover a new species.
What do you think attracts people to cryptids?
The Yeti, Bigfoot and Nessie are what I call celebrity cryptids. Why are people drawn to these creatures? For one thing, most of us like mysteries. And also, as humans, we take a keen interest in animals that exhibit a close likeness to us, especially mammals that are human-sized and bigger.
There's also a lot of media interest in such creatures.
That's true. The problem is that the media mainly talk about cryptids as monsters, fueling stereotypes that are hard to overcome. Myths and rumours of Bigfoot, Nessie or the Yeti are usually covered as sensational topics, and as a result, reporters and journalists tend to imply that cryptozoologists are all hoaxers.
Cryptozoology is often described as a pseudoscience. What do you say to that?
It's true that the field is still frowned upon by the scientific community. As for the majority of scientists, cryptozoology fails to adhere to scientific methods and standards of empirical research. However, advocates of the discipline assert that cryptozoology should be recognised as a legitimate science and classified as a subfield of zoology. For me, it spans zoology, popular culture, folklore, ethnography, anthropology, and many other sciences, and deserves to be taken seriously.
Thank you for being here with us today.
Czas przeznaczony na tę część egzaminu minął.